one of your early Christmas presents, next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. Along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Well, it's good to be with you as always here. We've done a lot more of these face-to-face. We haven't had to record one remote for quite a while. I'm curious to see what your lead-in means.
Well, you know, you and I had talked about this on the phone earlier in the week, that we were going to probably give the entire month of December's programs over to giving people a Christmas present, or a number of Christmas presents. Now, unlike many other programs who are trying to tell you what to think about things, we are trying to educate you on how to think about things. And that's one of our Christmas presents to you, as a little primer in how to think about certain topics and how certain arguments are framed and how you go about responding to them. Because without that, oftentimes, as we say in our classes, it's I think, I feel, I believe, and I hope, rather than I know to be a fact, and here's the documentation, which, honestly, even though emotion seems to win many arguments these days, it's mainly because people don't know how to argue back against emotional appeals. They don't know how to go back to it is written. Because if you think about it, scripturally, Christ, when he was challenged, never went to an emotional appeal. He went to, it is written, especially one of the biggest challenges of his entire life was he was led into the wilderness by the tempter, by the deceiver, by Satan, and who put him through some, well, tests and twisted the truth,
well,
emotionally appealing to him to do certain things or not, or to do certain things in certain ways. And Christ always, there's not one of those three different tests that Satan put up against him, did he come back and say, well, I feel that maybe this isn't the right thing to do, or I'm hoping that I would not have to do that, or whatever it might be.
Can we sit down and discuss it and come to some kind of common ground?
That's right. Never said that. What he said was, it is written. It is written. He went back to the revealed word of Scripture. He went back to absolute truth. He went back to documentation. In other words,
well, yeah,
and he being the perfect source of that documentation, it goes without saying, but he didn't argue back against somebody who used emotional appeals and twists of the truth and well-crafted and well-thought-out lies by trying to argue on their ground. He took it to a deeper and more permanent level. That's what we call presuppositional apologetics. Chuck and I are both big fans of the presuppositional method, where you basically get right down to the root of what's true, and you start as that as your foundation, and then you build everything up from there, or you tear down false arguments, as Scripture tells us to do, to tear down every high thing and false imagination, and take every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. Well, in order to be obedient to Christ and taking every thought captive, we have to start thinking like him. And one of the ways we need to start thinking about it is we need to take a look at that temptation in the wilderness and see that he didn't sit there and say, well, I think that that's the case, or I feel or I believe that you should be doing this way, or you shouldn't be doing that. It is written. God hath said. And he filled in the blank. And it's interesting, Charles, because what did Satan do? Did he try to argue those points? No, he went on to the next thing. He knew he was beaten. He went to the next thing. That's what we're trying to hopefully do over the next 2 or 3 weeks of programming, is use some examples that we've had of trying to help you think how you go about responding when the argument sounds really good, but you know it's flawed. How do you respond back to it in a way that leaves no doubt that you are going to win the argument? Because that's really what we're called to do. We're called to win these arguments, folks. We really are.
Right.
And we can't win them if we don't put on the mind of Christ. We can't win these arguments. We can't go against all those high things that are set against the knowledge of God. 2 Corinthians 10 says, we can't go up against those things unless we understand how to go about doing it. Not what to think, how to think. So that's what my little Christmas present opening was all about, Chuck.
Okay, well, that makes sense then.
Okay, well, good. I'm glad that it does. And I hope it made sense to our listeners.
That's kind of the bottom line, isn't it? You and I can understand all things all day long, and if we don't convey them to the listener, well, they'll run off and play video games or something.
Okay, well, we need to go ahead and start unwrapping this present before they get a little...
We're basically dealing with some correspondence that, let's assure everyone the way we're doing this is we're A, it's anonymous, B, we're going to generalize the arguments that are used because they're actually indicative of the generalized arguments that are out there floating around in favor. As anyone who has listened to our show in the past knows, that Barry and I are opposed to a calling of a new constitutional convention. And we're opposed to it on the basis, not necessarily that the things that people want to call the thing for are bad. We're against it on the basis that a constitutional convention is a last resort and a very dangerous thing to do from the viewpoint of remaking the Constitution. And the reason it's dangerous is because a constitutional convention, we believe we could prove from the historical record, simply cannot be controlled by a lower lawmaking body, despite the insistence by quote-unquote experts. And one of the reasons that we don't believe the experts is essentially they're speaking in terms of constitutional theory, and we're speaking in terms of historical fact. There is a vast difference between historical fact and constitutional theory. Because one of the things you get from historical fact is what has actually happened in the past, and what you're getting arguments from constitutional theory is, well, this should be the way this works. Well, who says who, essentially? Because if it doesn't comport with historical reality, then saying that it should happen this way is meaningless. Yeah, maybe it should happen that way, but it never has in the past. So one of the things we're going to try to do is refute a few of these kind of generalized arguments and see what the issue is. Now, the current move, and Ohio just passed SJR 5, into, well, it basically is now the 20th state to ask Congress to call for a balanced budget amendment by way of a constitutional convention. Now, exactly what we say is this, that basically you can call a constitutional convention for an amendment, a specific amendment, but once you call it, you can't control it. And the reason we say that is that Barry and I are fully aware that I came up with 6 constitutional conventions on a national basis called by something that was a national legislature or in the wake of a national revolutionary movement. And in every one of those cases, no lower lawmaking body was able to control a constitutional convention. A constitutional convention is the highest lawmaking body in the land. I've even been reading some work lately by a fellow who... gives a pretty good breakdown on what how a convention is defined. The problem is that he misdefines the idea. He says that a constitutional convention is actually a subordinate convention. There is no such thing as a subordinate convention, except in the case of something like, historically, maybe the Conference Convention of 1861, or maybe the Annapolis Convention of 1786 and the Mount Vernon Conference of 1785. Those really are subordinate because they're not called by a national lawmaking body. They're called by a state to get together and discuss things and have no plenipotentiary power whatsoever. A constitutional convention does have a plenipotentiary power, and what plenipotentiary means is that it has all authority. And they do. They have to, because they're making law that a legislature can't make. Now, in this case, for instance, can the legislature make a constitutional convention? According to Article 5.
According to Article 5, a state legislature cannot. Congress calls a convention.
Well, let's talk about the other way of getting a constitutional amendment.
Oh, well, of course, there's two ways in Article 5 in order to get an amendment. First is that Congress directly passes a document that amends the Constitution, and then once it receives two-thirds votes in each chamber of the legislature, of the Congress, the House and the Senate each have to vote by two-thirds majorities, then it has to be sent out to the states for ratification by three-quarters of the states, or 38 states, in order to ratify and put that amendment into the Constitution. That's way number one.
Yeah.
That's what I call the safe route.
Right, exactly. Then we've had 27 amendments passed that way.
That's right, including the Bill of Rights.
That's right.
The second method is still, if you read Article 5 carefully, Congress is still in control of this.
Yep.
But it says that upon application, and that's a key word, application, to apply for something means that you're filling out a request to get something. Now, there's nothing in the language that says that the request has to be fulfilled, except when the legislatures of two-thirds of the states,
34,
which is 34 states, all apply, then Congress shall call a convention. Now, the key word there is not the convention, it's call.
Yes.
The word call is the absolute penultimate hinge word. It doesn't say the legislatures call it. It says Congress shall call.
Yes.
Now, a call is an issue, and you and I talked about this, and I don't think I brought that document with me.
No, you didn't, but
But if you look at Webster's 1828 Dictionary of the American of the English Language, which he was writing this during the time of the founding, he was one of the contemporaries of the founders. These were the definitions that were commonplace to the colonists. And the idea of a call is to set up and create the parameters of an actual event or bringing people to a location for a specific purpose. So that has in itself that Congress, being the one that the founders rested the ability to call a convention yes. in, also have the ability. And actually, it should probably go without argument, but that seems to be the crux of most of people's arguments,
right.
that Congress has the final authority on all matters pertaining to that convention and that call, which would include the dates, the times, the places, the locations, the number, the qualifications for the delegates, the length of time that they can meet, how long they can spend on any one item, and we're going to talk about how that gets thrown off in a minute, and the duration of the convention itself, when they have to gavel down to quit, whether or not they've gotten finished or not. Now, every bit of that is up to Congress.
Right. It's who, what, when, where,
why, and how. Every bit of it.
And it's all up to Congress. That's the crux of our argument against. The crux of the argument for is the idea that somehow the states are in charge of those questions. Now, what we're basically saying is that you should only call a constitutional convention or ask for Congress to basically apply to Congress to call for that. And by the way, just to define call, this is number two, definition number two under Webster's 1828 dictionary, to convoke, to summon, to direct, or order to meet, to assemble by order or public notice, often with together, as the king called his council together, the president called together the Congress. So a Congress, at that point, by that definition, is in charge.
Yes.
Of a constitutional convention.
Up to a certain point.
Up to a certain point.
That point being, when the gavel drops to open the convention.
That's right.
As soon as that gavel drops, that convention goes live. And when it goes live with what's called plenipotent powers.
Yes. And the only reason we can say that is because
we've said it a lot of times. There
have been six of these, and six of them have been plenipotent. They've had plenipotentiary powers. And the reason we say that is out of every single one of the six. There has been a fundamental change in the government after that body met. Every single one.
Yes, absolutely has.
Now, that being said.
Now, Chuck, as you were, just as a little sidebar, you know that last weekend when our show was airing,
yes, yes.
I was actually in an impromptu debate with an attorney representing Michael Ferris and a group called Citizens for Self-Governance, who argued that there had been 32 conventions in America prior to the 1787 Philadelphia Convention.
And
all of them were national conventions.
National. Well, here's the problem. Okay, let's go with that. There is a logical fallacy called equivocation.
Yes, there is.
And by the use of an equivocation, you essentially change the definition of a word, or what you do is you pass through a gray area. And when you take the word and pass it through this kind of cloudy spot...
Would that be the emanations from the penumbras?
It might be. If you know Roe v. Wade, it's an emanation from a penumbra. That's right. It goes through a dark zone. And when it emerges, the word means something else. That's what's gone on here. National convention. Anytime two states got together to discuss a border issue or... You can name a zillion things. A trade agreement before the passage of the
Articles of Confederation,
or even after, and before the passage of the Constitution, the adoption of the Constitution. Anytime two states may have gotten together to discuss something, they're calling a national convention. And if I'm not mistaken, you told me they gave a specific, and one of those was the Annapolis Convention.
Yes.
The Annapolis Convention may have been national, quote unquote, but it had no plenipotentiary power because it was called by a state and not by the federal government, which was the Articles of Confederation Congress. And how many states showed up to that? Do you know off the top of your head? I know.
Oh, to the Annapolis Convention?
Yeah.
Five, wasn't it? Yeah.
Five.
Not including the host state of Maryland, because Annapolis is in Maryland. They refused to send anybody to this convention in their own capital.
Maryland refused to send delegates to this convention that was meeting in their capital. This is a very interesting thing. Now, there's a reason why that happened that way. There really wasn't any interest in changing the Articles of Confederation in the late summer of 1786. But what happened later on that year that suddenly everybody kind of got excited over it?
Well, there was this little problem they had with commerce.
Well, there was another issue.
Now, which one are you talking about?
Shays Rebellion.
Of course.
Commerce.
Well, that had something to do with commerce, too. It was taxes on whiskey.
It was taxes to pay off war indebtedness.
Oh, that's right. Taxes for the war indebt. That's right. I get that. I get Shays and the Whiskey Rebellion sometimes twisted up in my head.
It's a long story. We're not going to go into it. But the fact is that the impetus for the Annapolis Convention was interstate commerce. But nobody was excited enough about it to actually send delegates, five states. Other states named delegates who basically felt no compelling reason to show up, so they didn't come. So Shays Rebellion happens, and all of a sudden everybody's hot for a constitutional convention because things were made up about it that simply weren't true. In any case, by the spring of 1787,
thank you, Alexander Hamilton and Henry Knox.
12 states were ready to show up for that.
Yes. Yeah. 12.
12.
But there were 13 under the 13 states who all had to agree under the Articles of Confederation.
Right. Right. So going on with this, basically, sure, you have to have a compelling reason to call a constitutional convention. And what made Philadelphia different from conventions that came before it was the fact that it was called by Congress. And if you want to know the truth of that statement, you can go out to our www.principledpolicy.com. And in the sidebar, under our position on an Article 5 convention, there is a subpage that is the resolutions of the state and the federal states and the federal government calling for the Philadelphia Convention. And it's clickable. You can read it. In any case, it's a documentable truth that this one was called by the federal government and therefore had plenipotentiary power. Now, really, before we go too much further into that, because we've used up 20 minutes already, and I had no idea we were going to be there this far, not any further than this, I want to talk about some of the arguments that are being used in favor of a constitutional convention. The big deal right now is the balanced budget amendment. This is what the supposedly the convention is going to be limited to discussing, and let's talk about that balanced budget amendment. One of the arguments that we're getting, we made an argument when we testified against SJR 5 that basically the balanced budget amendment really is meaningless. And it's meaningless because it has a quote-unquote emergency clause. Now, the emergency clause essentially says that with a vote of, I think, two-thirds of the houses, if there is some kind of an emergency, and they specifically name military.
There's nothing in the language that says two-thirds of each house. It just says, in the event of a call of a national emergency.
It depends. If you look at the one that's out there floating around, yes. If you look at the more nebulous one that's being passed by the...
I was looking at the one that the Ohio legislature passed.
It's got nothing in it.
It's got nothing in it about percentages or anything else.
The federal one that's out there floating around has this thing about military, you know, it has to be a war type situation, which I would remind everyone, we've been in a military action except for very short bursts since 1941. So the idea that this is somehow a protection against overspending with this clause in it means that this essentially amendment is worthless. Now, if the Ohio one holds and some other states are also passing, it simply says emergency, and that includes economic emergency, states of emergency having to do with quote-unquote national security. I think it's been broadened over the national security question. Barry, that's meaningless. Now, the arguments that we're getting are simply that the language contains something that says expenditures will not exceed 16% of the GNP, or the GDP, gross domestic product. Barry, 16%? Of the gross domestic product is going to be confiscated by the federal government?
Well, if you think about it, on some of the testimony we gave earlier, because of our hole in our deficit, and we talked about this on a couple weeks ago on the program, you know, we have really a $205 trillion deficit because that counts all the off-book obligations we have as well. In order just to keep a pace with it, we'd have to set aside for every year from here on out 10% of the gross domestic product. Now, they're saying 16% could be taken and just... that's ridiculous, Charles. Right now, we're in a big enough problem because so much of our gross domestic product is not producing because of the spending that's going on in Congress. It has nothing to do with how they're allocating.
Right.
It has to do with how they're actually just... finding new ways to spend it.
Well,
I guess that's an allocation if you want to be technical.
On the day that we're recording this, I read a story today on Breitbart.com that talked about the Congress is currently trying to push through a $1 trillion farm bill. $1 trillion. That's a lot of money, people. That's a lot of money. And let me tell you what's in there. A lot of corporate welfare. Now, we'll come back to that point a little later, time permitting. But I want to go on to the next point, and that is that basically there are specific emergency procedures that are in this amendment. There aren't. Some people are talking about a two-thirds vote by both houses in order to go into an emergency situation that would allow spending over and above the 16% level. Let me tell you something. When it comes re-election time, and we're back to not really paying attention to what's being spent, it'll be no trouble at all to get two-thirds of the House and Senate to come right out and extend that limit. Just as it's been no trouble all along to extend the debt ceiling. Yeah, there was some trouble the last time, but you notice it all went away, and now everybody's saying, boy, that was a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
You know, too much political capital spent. That's exactly what you're going to get if this amendment's in place or not. As Barry and I have been very willing to say all along, this is not a Constitution problem.
No, not at all.
This is a representation problem. This all depends on who your representatives are and what they're willing and not willing to do. and our representatives are not willing to take it on the chin and actually start cutting spending. They're still making that political hay by giving away stuff. So that's really what's going on here. These guys want the leeway, and they really think that they're going to be able to point to this and say, see, we're restricted by a balanced budget amendment. Well, first of all, I don't think that since Congress is in charge of how the thing is run, who gets appointed, how they get appointed, blah, 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 they're going to let anybody in on a constitutional convention that's serious about reining in federal spending and serious about putting safeguards in there. For instance, I'm getting an argument here that I have to laugh about. Says in essence that the amendment will contain specific penalties for any federal official, including the president and the legislatures and legislators in Congress who violate it, possibly automatic impeachment or recall. Well, okay. There are major problems with that.
Well, but even before we talk about the problems, let me just say one thing. Good luck with that.
Yeah.
I think it's been tried here recently, and the big problem has been the lack of fortitude by those who already have the authority to do this.
That's right. That's exactly right. These guys are suddenly going to develop intestinal fortitude by virtue of the fact that they've got this balanced budget amendment gun in their back, basically, which is a licorice gun, if you know what I mean. You know, it's a toy gun that basically, if you don't like it, you just take a bite of it and eat it. It's meaningless.
Yes.
And this thing, you know, they're talking about the balanced budget amendment in these arguments as if it's a solid thing, which it is not. It's nebulous. The argument that this amendment will have teeth. None of the drafts have teeth.
Well, Chuck, that's just like anything else. You know, when they're in their infancy, they don't have teeth, but after they grow up, then that's when they start coming in. The only problem is legislation isn't like an organic, biological, you know, whether it be human being or animal. They don't grow teeth later. You have to actually draw them up with teeth in them in order for them to have teeth.
Well, let's point something out. When I made the argument to someone regarding the 27th Amendment and how it was bypassed within a year of its passage, and if you don't understand that, what I'm talking about, you can go out and read my testimony at www.principledpolicy.com on SJR 5, where I point out what happened. The 27th Amendment took 204 years to pass, and once it was passed, it took less than a year to bypass. And that requires an intervening election before a representative in government can get a pay raise. In other words, you have to stand for re-election before you can get a raise. Okay. They bypassed that almost immediately. And guess who did it? Conservatives. Sadly. Because by the time that passed, the House, I believe both houses were in the hands of Republicans. So that amendment was immediately bypassed by those Republicans and fellow travelers in the Democratic Party. I don't think anybody was really against it. No, we want to be able to vote ourselves a pay raise whenever, or to get one whenever we want it. So they just created a commission to give them one without their input. Okay, what that means. We've got another argument here having to do with the balanced budget amendment. That's basically, I call a variation of what I call the whirling dervish argument. And that is basically that, we're in a crisis situation. We need to do something, anything, to rein in these lawless spenders. And my reply to that is obviously, you know, this is this flail around in the dark and with a pipe, and eventually you'll hit something. Well, what will you hit is the question. This is not well thought out. This is not a well thought out argument. It's basically, we've reached such a crisis, it doesn't matter what we do, it would all be positive.
I call that the whistling past the graveyard syndrome.
I would remind people out there that there are people on the left who would love nothing better than to be appointed to a constitutional convention so they can propose the elimination of the Second Amendment. I just sent Barry an article yesterday that talked about the fact that there is a group out there that wants to repeal the 22nd Amendment. The 22nd Amendment is the limit on presidential terms to two. This has been tried. This was attempted the last time there was a Democrat in office, Bill Clinton. People wanted to extend his term. And now people want to extend Barack Obama, give him a third term. You'll notice that nobody was arguing in favor of it when George Bush was president on either side of the aisle, which I found very interesting. That movement died away. And so there are all kinds of mischief out there that can be done. There are people who would love to change voting laws, completely federalize voting laws and make it possible for illegals to vote, which you'd need a constitutional convention for. There are all kinds of mischief out there. And believe me, a balanced budget amendment is the last one on those people's list. As we saw when we testified, the left-leaning groups came out and testified against it on the basis that their budgets would be cut.
Exactly. It's all about the money. Follow the money.
Follow the money.
That's another one of our key points here is when you're looking at these arguments, follow the money.
And the fact is that the bottom line is these groups would love nothing better than to grab hold of the mechanism of a constitutional convention. And let's not kid ourselves. There is some kind of a crazy idea out there being pushed by conservative guys that only conservatives are going to be appointed as delegates to this thing. Well, again, we see that Congress is in charge. And I would point out the idea that someone go out and look at the Ohio's Constitution Modernization Commission. Basically put together by a supposedly conservative House, a supposedly conservative Senate, and a supposedly conservative governor in Ohio, it is a hotbed of progressivism. One of the first things they're going to do, I will state this with a certainty approaching metaphysical certitude, they're going to recommend that the Ohio Marriage Amendment be chucked. There are a number of things that they're going to recommend be chucked. And also a number of things that are going to be added, and it's going to be a progressive wonderland. Cloning things that cloning research funding. All kinds of funding for all kinds of different programs, corporate welfare, basically controlling the purse strings on conservative type ideas will be severely restricted by this group. So if you really think that only conservatives are going to be appointed to this body, I would suggest you go out and look up the Constitution Modernization Commission.
Yes.
And see who's on it, because these people aren't conservative. Bob Taft, Joanne Davidson, various retired law professors, legislators, movers and shakers of all stripes and descriptions. I won't say there isn't a single conservative in there, because I'm sure there are. I can't think of any. And there are people from...
Well, they would argue that because the Speaker of the House and the Senate President are quote-unquote members, that's their conservative. Now, the point is that there's about a dozen legislators who's on there from the both chambers, both parties, but it's the 20, I think it's 21 members that were picked to be on the commission who are quote-unquote members of the public, like the former House Speaker Davidson, the former Governor Taft.
Right.
Somebody like John Gilligan's daughter, who's an attorney in Cincinnati, who's Kathleen Sebelius' sister. Herb Asher, who's a political science professor at Ohio State University and who's not conservative.
Yeah.
And I know some of these people, so I know that they're not conservatives, okay? But, you know, even when it gets right down to that, Chuck, the ultimate issue we've got is you have to look at this issue in light of what the Constitution actually says. And that's the problem with most, if not all, of the arguments coming from the pro-constitutional convention or amendments, whatever, convention of the state, whatever you want to call this beast, is that they very quickly run away from the language of the Constitution and supply their own best wishes for how things ought to be. And And it's almost de rigueur. I mean, I've seen it in everybody who's ever testified on this or spoken on this who's been in favor of it. Ultimately, whether within the body of their presentation or immediately after somebody who knows what they're talking about asks a penetrating question, they're off away from the whole issue. They don't want to be bound by the change of the Constitution, Chuck.
No. And
they
want
to be. They want to be away from Article 5 and go out to just because I said so, that's the reason why you should support this.
Okay, let's talk about that because what it has to do with, the pro side has chosen, again, I make this statement, to go with constitutional theory rather than historical fact. And in so doing, they have a host of modern day, quote unquote, constitutional scholars. Now, the one thing that binds these constitutional scholars together, and by the way, they do not agree with who would be in control of a convention. For instance, Robert Nadelson says unequivocally that it would be the states. He cites, he miscites lots of history to point out that the states were in control of the Philadelphia Convention, of the delegate selection, and therefore the states would be in charge of it now. Folks, let me tell you that we're going to have to shorthand this. The states in 1787 were sovereign entities who had basically surrendered nothing or virtually nothing except the power to make war and the power to make treaties unless the treaty didn't fit the needs of the state, in which case they were free to ignore it. That was the only power they'd invested Congress with. So the states were sovereign entities and were in control of their delegations, or in control of appointing their delegations. In 2013, that no longer exists. We have an overriding legal framework, and that is Article 5. That language did not exist in the Articles of Confederation. The only thing that existed was if there was going to be a change in the Constitution, which was the Articles of Confederation, it had to be unanimous. And in fact, that was ignored at the Philadelphia Convention in lieu of the new ratification procedure. Okay, so how do these guys come to this conclusion? Now, another guy that you and I have read and has a very different view is that, well, maybe a convention can be controlled. Nobody knows for sure. But if it is, then that would be in the hands of the federal courts. Well, there's a big difference between the states and the federal courts. And yet, this fellow's name is Russell Kaplan. He wrote a book called Constitutional Brinksmanship. Robert Nadelson quotes and cherry picks from Kaplan to support his case when, in fact, Kaplan does not support his case. A third one that everybody wants to ignore, which you found, was a fellow by the name of Neal. Thomas H. Neal, who wrote a report for Congress under the auspices of the Congressional Research Service, which is a service they employ to give them the historical background to do the things that they do when they're monkeying with things like constitutional law. And monkeying with it is essentially what they're doing. And what Thomas Neal says is, sure, you can control a convention, but it would be the Congress who would be in control of it. So you've got three different opinions about who can control a convention, and none of them, not a single one, comports with history.
No.
We contend that the delegates are in charge, which makes delegates selection the paramount consideration in calling a constitutional convention, which the states don't have any charge in. Okay, so what are we talking about here? Why am I bringing these three guys up? Every single one of them has a flawed hermeneutic of the Constitution, which is what Barry was alluding to at the beginning when he started talking about it. Okay, big word. That's a nice $3 word, a hermeneutic.
Yeah, I like that $3 word.
Okay, if you know anything about apologetics or Bible study, You may have heard that word, but you may not know what it means, so we're going to give you a working definition of it, essentially. A hermeneutic is a framework by which you interpret what you read. And it is a specific set of rules for understanding what it is that you are reading. So in other words, when Nadelson and Kaplan and Neal read Article 5, Nadelson shows what his hermeneutic is in subsequent papers he's written, in which he basically calls for a third method of amending the Constitution rather than the two in the Constitution itself. And that third method is by treaty. He wants to use the supremacy clause of Article 6 to say that since treaties are the highest law in the land, if a treaty is signed and ratified, then that supersedes the Constitution itself. That's kind of an absurdity, if you think about it.
Wasn't it circular reasoning?
Absolutely, it's circular reasoning. That's right. It assumes the conclusion that you're setting out to prove. Now, I've had arguments from people who say, but, this is a one-off for Nadelson. It's one mistake in an otherwise pristine position on a constitutional convention.
I can't believe that I'm going to actually invoke this name or this phrase in this conversation in a positive light. No, what it really is, Chuck, is what we would call an inconvenient truth. Thank you, Al Gore.
Yes, exactly. The fact is that this is part and parcel of Robert Nadelson, a retired law professor from the University of Montana and a retired professor of both law and constitutional history. So he really should know better. And in fact, I've posited all along that he does know better, but that he was paid a princely sum by groups like American Legislative Exchange Council and the Goldwater Institute to do what lawyers often do, rather than what they're supposed to do, that is to find a method by which something can do in the law what it's not supposed to do. And that's something he wanted to find in the law that would do what it's not designed to do, is have a state-controlled constitutional convention. Because that's really not what's supposed to happen. The Constitutional Convention is called precisely because either there are two reasons to call one. There is no legal authority at all, and one has to be created in a revolutionary situation. In other words, it's a provisional government until such time as a fixed law government can be created. Or the law that exists to govern the legislatures is inadequate. I ask you a question. Is the law inadequate to govern the legislatures in the case of a balanced budget?
No. The only inadequacy is in the people's willingness to hold those officials to the standards that they supposedly swear to uphold and protect when they take the oath. That's really what it gets down to, Chuck. As you said, we don't have a document problem. We have a representation problem. But even worse than that, we don't have a representation problem. We have a management problem.
Exactly.
And the managers are us.
Us.
We, the people, are the managers. And our employees, the elected officials, are not following the manual, our operating guidelines, our rules of conduct for this company called the United States in the Constitution. And that is the problem. So honestly, whether you're fantasizing about what might possibly be with some of these folks thinking, oh, well, all this stuff, yeah, well, we know the history of it and it was all bad, but this time it's going to be different.
Yeah.
I have to laugh because it's the definition of insanity. We're going to do the same thing we've always done in the same way we've always done it, and we're going to expect a different result.
Right.
Now, they'll argue, well, this has never been done before. Well, yeah, it has been done before, folks. You just don't know your history. And the problem is, if you don't know what's come before you, as George Santayana, the philosopher, said, those who will not learn from history are condemned to repeat it.
Exactly.
And that could be, now granted, the 1787 convention left us with a framework that was fantastically adept for this young country, but because it was based in a shared moral foundation. You look at the history of our country, we teach this in class, we had a moral center in this country. We have lost that, by and large, in this country today. I was having a conversation with a former legislator who works in the administration, actually works kind of pseudo in the administration, who said this very same thing. He goes, 20 years, 30 years ago, 20 years ago in Columbus, you might have had one every 6 months or a year of a young person being shot on the streets. He goes, it's now happening almost every day. And he said, we don't have a moral foundation anymore. That's why we're having trouble corralling those people we give power to. Because without some absolute standard to hold them to, every man will do what is right in his own eyes.
His own eyes, yeah. Let's talk about this just for a second, because what's really gone on here? Nadelson has cut loose from the idea of fixed law. Kaplan has cut loose from the idea of fixed law. Other proponents of a constitutional convention, Lou Euler from the 80s, cut loose from an idea about fixed law. Other people, Lauren Enns from I Am an American, Dranius from the Goldwater Institute. All these guys have cut loose.
How about Matt Spaulding from the Heritage Foundation? We heard him a year and a half ago at the We the People convention basically saying, when the founders talked about the law of God and nature, that he was talking about Greek and Roman.
Greek and Roman law. Yeah, law. Which is an absurdity on its face. And when questioned about that, by the way, what did he say? Well, it may not be true, but it's something that we have to call on to win people to our side. We have to go there, even though that may be what the actual facts of the case are, which is a perfect example of how lawyers think about these things. Cut loose from the foundation and just float. And we'll get people to our side, and then we'll moor back up. We'll re-moor to the foundation. That's not going to happen. When do you spring it on these people that, oh, by the way, we were kidding you? This is Jenny and I have talked about this in terms of salvation. You basically hit people up with all your problems are going to be solved, and all this and that, and another thing, all the great thing that's going to happen to you when you get saved. And when those things don't happen, in fact, things get worse for them, you hit them with, oh, by the way, I forgot to tell you, that's not really how this works. Very often it gets worse. Oops. So when you hit them with that, then what happens? They backslide because they were told everything was going to be fine. Okay, so let's go back to this. This person basically cites specifically Robert Nadelson and talks about how Nadelson has quoted the founding fathers and many of the framers. I want to go specifically back to this, and this supposedly shows that he's showing the original intent of the Constitution and that Nadelson's an original intent guy. Nadelson is not an original intent guy. Nadelson is one of those people who wants to reinterpret the Constitution from a conservative quote-unquote basis, whatever that means, versus a quote-unquote liberal basis. So what he does is he goes out to the founders and cherry-picks. He cherry-picks quotes that seem to support his position. And I'm not making this accusation lightly, but I can tell you that when he came out and made this declaration about how sorry he is to have to point it out to us, and that he really doesn't want it to be this way, but it's becoming clear to him that treaty law can supersede the Constitution. Guess what, folks? He ignored probably one of the most primary elements that you can possibly study to see that that's false, and that's the Federalist Papers. specifically Federalist number 33. If anyone would have agreed normally in modern day with Robert Nadelson, it would have been Alexander Hamilton, the arch nationalist, who really wanted to eliminate the states entirely. He didn't want there to be states. He wanted to have a king president, quote unquote, who served for life. Well, pardon me, during periods of good behavior. And we've seen what that amounts to. Federalist 33 is, Hamilton is extremely clear. He states it in the open. It's not couched in any kind of crazy terminology or really weird language. And I will be paraphrasing because I don't have it memorized. What he says is that the Supremacy Clause of Article 6 says specifically that treaties are the highest law of the land, but that they must be made pursuant to the Constitution. So a treaty cannot supersede the Constitution under any stretch of the imagination.
Well, let's hope that the Supreme Court's reading that right now.
Want to bet?
I don't want to lay money on that.
This is one of the big issues that I've had with this kind of argumentation. Going back to the cult of the expert. My expert says this, my expert says that. Okay, thank you. I'm going to go with a man who was at the convention, and I'm also going to go with the not just the founders, the writers of the Constitution, but more importantly, really, and these are the forgotten guys, the ratifiers. What did the ratifiers have to say? Because the real meaning of the Constitution is from the ratifiers. Where do you find out what the ratifiers had to say, and how often is Nadelson or Kaplan or
anybody
Neil
you named earlier
or any of the above, how often are they quoting the Federalist or the ratifiers, and where would one go to read the ratifiers, do you think?
Well, I know you know, and I believe that the point is that each of those states were called into convention to ratify that document, and each of those conventions took notes, and each of those notes were compiled by someone by the name of Eliot, I believe, and it's called Eliot's Notes on the Debates of the Conventions.
And it's an excellent book, and guess what, folks? You can get it dirt cheap and sometimes free. If you go to Google Books, books.google.com, and do a search on Eliot's Debates, a free copy comes up. And yeah, it's not in the best condition, but you can read it. And who cares? Once you get past the little glitches, and it's a lot of them are PDF copies, but a lot of them on Google Books are indexed, which means you can go to a table of contents and go out to specific places and read them, which I have done. I have a copy on my Kindle, and it's not in the best condition, but I can read it. And the fact is, I can find places where people are saying the Supremacy Clause is dangerous. And it's usually not in terms of treaties. It was so well understood that treaties couldn't possibly supersede the Constitution. What they were more worried about was taxation.
Yep.
Well, let me ask you a question. Is that a little out of control? And what's it going to look like if we really do confiscate and spend 16% of the GDP?
I shudder to think what it's going to look like, Chuck. It's going to be frightening.
Yeah. Now, the fact is that Nadelson, there are two views you can take of what he's done. Because if I could find it, this biochemist with a Kindle and internet access could find these things, do you suppose a professor of law and constitutional history could have found these things and, in fact, did find these things? So you've got two choices, and there really are only two. Bad scholarship or essentially fraud. Which is it, do you suppose?
I'm reticent to cry fraud, but when the weight of the evidence, the preponderance of the evidence leans in a direction, you tend to have to go that way.
Yeah, unfortunately. This is what I've been saying. When you have experts who are collecting large sums of money from think tanks, taking large corporate donations, things tend to get a little skewed because lawyers are paid to do what they're paid to do. And very often, as anyone, especially in the defense, I have no idea what type of lawyer. I'm guessing Nadelson is a constitutional law scholar. I don't know for sure. And another thing to point out about that is that unless he's a professor at a handful, maybe five, law schools around the country, mm-hmm. he's teaching what's called the case law approach.
Yes, that's right.
And he's retired now, so he's not teaching at all. He's writing papers. Okay, and books. Okay, what is the case law approach? The case law approach is an evolutionary law approach. And by that I mean, the law is not fixed. It changes as the quote-unquote needs of society change. So, as we've talked about in past programs, if you take a flight around the world and your compass is off by 1 degree, when you get to the other side, and I think Dr. Vollacord and I talked about this last week, when you get to the other, you come back all the way around the world, how close are you to the airport that you started at? Well, you're not very close. Now, let's say you start off 10 degrees. How many times around the world do you have to go before you're flying in the exact opposite direction? Not too many.
Not too many.
And that's exactly the problem we're having. As the case law approach, case law builds on case law builds on case law. None of it refers back to the original language of the Constitution. Well, nor
that gets lost in the fog of past time. That's the big problem, because when you've got so many emanations coming from these penumbras that you're writing about, you tend to lose track of the fact that the emanations are coming from actual words and actual phrases, actual restrictions upon actions, actual mandates upon actions that our Constitution sets forward for each of our branches of government. When you get away from that and start talking about the emanations coming from the shadows of those words, or as Oliver Wendell Holmes said in his majority opinion in Missouri versus Holland, when it becomes a living thing that even the creator, the begetters of it, couldn't have foreseen its growth and its expansion, well, certainly you've lost all track of the origin. And what you end up with is like that compass being off. You are not in the place you should be. And usually, Chuck, what happens is when you find yourself somewhere where you don't know how you got there and you don't know where to get to from there, what are you?
You're lost.
You're lost.
And that's what the problem that we're having. These quote-unquote experts are essentially simply fighting over whose case law you're going to accept. Now, you can go back and quote the founders, but you have to quote them in their context. You can't rip it out and say, well, this supports my position, and then go on to a case law approach. There's nothing wrong with the case law approach if you understand two basic things. One, case law applies to the litigants. And two, you can't change the foundational law by reinterpreting that law by case law. Case law has to actually apply the tenets of the concrete law. And what Nadelson is arguing for, and Kaplan is arguing for, and Neal is arguing for, I don't know if he's an attorney or not. I think Kaplan is. And all these other guys from the Heritage Foundation and from Mike Ferris's people and these guys, they're all arguing from this same case law approach in which you cut free from the mooring of the fixed law of the Constitution and reinterpret it from a quote-unquote conservative case law or liberal case law approach. And therein lies the problem. Constitutional attorneys, unless they go to a handful of schools, never crack the Constitution. They only crack case laws.
Right, exactly.
Supreme Court, state court, federal court, they look at all those decisions and they never look at the text of the Constitution itself. Well, that's all the time we have for today. That's nowhere near what I wanted to get through, but this is why I did not sit down and type out replies to these things, because it takes about the same amount of time as it was that we talked through this. So we're going to have more for you next week. We don't know exactly what the topic will be. Maybe it'll be similar. Maybe it'll be different. But join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.